is The Guardian. I'm Rafika Tuma, coming to you from Gadigal land. And this is The Full Story.
Thank you very much, Deputy Speaker, and I rise to oppose the motion moved by...
The last time...
I will not.
But now, as Labour women outnumber men in the caucus, why are the only successors mentioned mostly men?
The names are Jim Chalmers, the names are Mark Butler, it's Tony Burke, it's sometimes Chris Bowen. It's a very occasionally Tanya Plibersek, but we're not really having a conversation about who are the next women who will be the next Julia Gillard.
Today, political reporter Krishani Danji on the Labour Party's women in leadership problem. It's Monday, the 10th of August. Krishani, welcome back to Full Story.
Hi, Ravka.
So you've written about Labour having a women in leadership problem. You've been working in the Canberra bubble for a while. What have you noticed?
It's a really fascinating set of circumstances, Rafika, because what we've sort of seen is Labour does have a huge number of women in its caucus. It's more than 50% women in the caucus. There's more than 50% women in the cabinet. And yet, when we have this conversation, which the media loves to do around who's going to be the next leader, when you talk to people internally within the party, it's very much sort of centered on the men that will take over next. The names are Jim Chalmers, the names are Mark Butler, it's Tony Burke, it's sometimes Chris Bowen. It's a very occasionally Tanya Plibersek, but we're not really having a conversation about who are the next women who will be the next Julia Gillard, for example, who's going to be the next female prime minister coming from Labour. And it's something that I'd sort of noticed for a little while and that kind of came to me the other day. And I was like, why aren't we talking about the women in the party? Because we have so many senior women. And as I said, the cabinet is more than 50% women. Mm-hmm. So why aren't we having that conversation? And there are what I found quite a number of factors that go to the makeup of the factions, who are the factional leaders, who is aligned with Anthony Albanese, who's not. Those are the sorts of questions now that need to be answered that lead to this question.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm curious why people are talking about Albanese's successor now, or if this is just a conversation that is already happening and you've noticed this pattern that the answers are all men.
It's a question that we love to talk about no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Albanese is in the middle of his second term as leader. The sort of expectations are from most people that, you know, if things don't kind of drastically change, he will go to the next election. And then after that, it's sort of a we'll see once he's in his third term whether he wants to stay and try and run for a fourth or whether he hands over. But people are always, I think in almost every country or every party or every state, you're always thinking about who's next. And so you have, sometimes you have succession plans. And at the moment, so of the names that I spoke about before, when you look at public polls, people sort of talk most about Jim Chalmers because he's very recognisable. He's the treasurer. And you sort of often see a trend that goes from, you know, becoming a treasurer to becoming the next leader. We saw it with Scott Morrison. We saw it with Paul Keating. And then a name like Mark Butler has been coming forward a lot more recently. And he's the person that's kind of talked about internally. The reason for that is because he is, other than the Prime Minister, who's of the left faction, and now the left faction does actually have a majority in the caucus, which is really important for determining, you know, which side votes on the next leader. Mark Butler's the sort of second most senior person. He's very, very close to the Prime Minister. They're good friends, they're allies, they've been together for a really long time. He's quite popular within the caucus. And so even though he doesn't necessarily have the same recognition as someone like Jim Chalmers does, who is from the right faction and from Queensland, he's very popular internally, and the left faction is very coordinated and very united, which means that they're more likely to vote as a bloc. Someone like Tanya Plibersek, though, who is also from the left faction, is not close to the Prime Minister. A lot of the reason for that is because she became Bill Shorten, who was a member of the right faction, his deputy back in 2013. And so that kind of really fractured their relationship because he would have thought should have supported him for the leadership instead, and also sort of frustrated some of the other members of the left faction that were there at the time. So that relationship doesn't help and sort of means that, you know, while she has incredible PR, incredible street appeal. People know her. One Labor MP remarked to me, like, when you walk down the street with her, everyone wants a photo. She might have that public appeal, but she doesn't have caucus support.
And you've described there the importance of proximity with the Prime Minister. And we've previously reported how some say Albanese has extraordinary control of his cabinet and caucus. I'm curious how that might impact how senior women are able to progress in the party.
So when you look at who is in the Prime Minister's inner circle, there are two women who are some of the most powerful people in the government, and that's Penny Wong and Katie Gallagher. But both of them are in the Senate, so they're not like a sort of direct kind of threat to Albanese, as it were, for leadership, because both of them enjoy being in the Senate, and neither has made any indication whatsoever that they would want to move to the House. That's the first part. The other element is just that, you know, internally they're sort of seeing as being in the latter half rather than the first half or the former half of their career. And so they're sort of not really looked at as potentially moving, even though, again, Penny Wong, someone who has a lot of public recognition, you know, a lot of public know-how. But the reason why the sort of proximity to Albanese makes such a difference is because, you know, as you say, and as we have said previously, like, he runs the Labor Party in a very united way. And so people look at and listen to what he says sort of very firmly. And so because he has this power and control over the party, if he was to endorse someone in the event that the party is still doing well and he still holds that unity and he still holds that kind of power and popularity within the party room, you could expect that the person that he endorses or that he supports, again, not that he's talking about this, not that, you know, he's making any kind of moves to say that he's going to quit in the next kind of 2 years or, you know, even ahead of the following election, that someone that who he is close to would have a much bigger mm-hmm. advantage than someone that he is not close to.
And I was going to say that my mind then goes to Tanya Plibersek, but you've kind of already touched on why it's going to be difficult for her to move up. Are there any other women candidates?
Well, if I could add one more point with Tanya Plibersek, when I was sort of talking about the kind of public versus the private, the way that leadership ballots have worked in the past is that you have a branch, sort of a rank and file member vote, which counts for 50%, and then a caucus vote, which also counts for 50%. And so a lot of people internally say that Plibersek being so popular with the public, that she would likely have more support in that kind of rank and file membership, but not as much in the caucus. When it comes to the other women that we are talking about, people talk about someone like Claire O'Neill. The challenges for her are that she's a member of the right faction, which already has a minority, but she's also a member of the Victorian right faction, which is run by Richard Marles, that's controlled by Richard Marles. And so in the sort of circumstance where if Albanese left today and Mark Butler became the new leader, someone like Claire O'Neill, who's a member of the right and a member of Victoria, might become a deputy leader. And then suddenly the conversation changes and she's, as someone said, a stone's throw away from being the leader. So there are sort of these scenarios where things can change and politics can move very quickly, and then suddenly there are more women in the conversation. But I mean, in terms of someone like O'Neill, she doesn't have the factional kind of support that someone like Richard Marles does. The right as well is very split. And that's where someone like Jim Chalmers in Queensland would struggle as well to get support from the whole right faction. I mean, it literally, Rafka, all comes down to numbers and the way that these factions work and the way that they're split across lines. So the other thing is that, like, all the factional leaders across the different states, they're all men as well. The ones that kind of have that power to make these decisions, like, it's Richard Marles in Victoria, it's Jim Chalmers in Queensland, it's Tony Burke and Chris Bowen, both have like sub-factions of the right in New South Wales. Albanese is obviously the leader of the left, both nationally and in New South Wales. And then it's someone like Don Farrell, who's a senator, who runs the sort of smaller states of South Australia, Tasmania. All of these people are the ones that kind of have the ultimate say. So even though, to sort of boil this conversation down, there are women like Tanya Plibersek, like Claire O'Neill, others that are kind of talked about, even those who are in the generation below Claire O'Neill. People talk about Rebecca White, who was recently elected to Tasmania. She's a former Labor leader of Tasmania. things that need to change are really who the factions are run mm-hmm. by, is what people say.
And so if the power brokers are men, does that create a cultural impact on women's ability to progress, or does it all boil down to numbers and structure?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, because when you look at the cabinet is also determined by the factions. So there are the left and the right will have control as to who they nominate for certain cabinet positions, or rather they'll put forward names to the cabinet and then the prime minister will decide where those names go and what portfolios they get allocated. So you can definitely see that, you know, no matter what, the factions are putting a lot of senior competent women forward for those senior roles. It's just, I think when you get to that next step of who is then from a senior cabinet position the leader, that's where there seems to be this real gap between supporting men versus supporting women.
And I'm a real outsider to the Canberra world. And looking in from the outside, I see Labor's got gender quotas since 1994. Women make up more than half of the Labor caucus right now. And that seems like they're making more progress on this front compared to other parties. Is that right? And does that impact whether there could be progression for women in the Labor Party, more so than we may see in other parties, where we know the Liberal Party have a women problem, for example, as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a huge difference. I mean, in the Liberal Party, there's not a conversation about another female leader. I mean, we had Susan Lee, who was there, and she was undermined almost the entire time that she was in power. Labor does have a plethora of women, and so there's a huge number of women that have been elected, and obviously their quota system has worked. I think it sort of does ultimately come down to the sort of factional element of it. There are, as you say, a majority of women in the caucus. There are, when you sort of look at the outer elements of the Labor Party, the national president, the two vice presidents are all women. And that's really, you know, for the first time, up until they announced their resignation, Sally McManus and Michelle O'Neill led the Australian Council of Trade Unions, a very influential part of the Labor movement. But it feels like it sort of comes down to those factional power brokers is what people inside Labor have sort of said to me. Who the factions are led by at the moment, as I said before, it is mostly men. The people that are closest to Albanese is someone like Mark Butler. That's why he's very much in the conversation. Mm-hmm. He's very popular amongst colleagues. So things definitely can change. It's just that at the moment, the conversations that we're having, or rather not having, seem to just be very, very focused on those men and those men that do lead those factions.
We'll be right back. And I'm curious whether this clear women in leadership problem also carries an intersectionality. Do we see this problem extend to race?
Yes. I mean, I think the amount of diversity, people from Indigenous or non-European backgrounds, has been slowly increasing across Parliament, but it is still very, very low. There's around 20 people within Labor of a non-European or Indigenous background out of more than 120 members. So the stats are still kind of low. They're kind of getting there. But yeah, when you look at the cabinet, you have people like Anna Lee, who is from a non-European background, who's gaining seniority, but she's from WA, from the left, doesn't have that kind of factional power. It is something that feels very much like it'll take more time because it feels like it's newer, that the number of MPs from a non-European, from a diverse, from a multicultural background is sort of slowly growing. And it doesn't feel like there's necessarily as much emphasis on that within the party. I mean, they've definitely kind of fixed the gender imbalance across the caucus. This is sort of the next kind of element of being properly representational of the country.
And I might end on asking Krishani whether you think there's a chance we could see change anytime soon in the makeup of the leadership of the Labor Party.
It feels like, based on the current makeup, that things won't necessarily change super quickly. But at the same time, in politics, anything can happen. I mean, I sort of gave the scenario a bit earlier around, like, if Mark Butler did become the next leader, then he might pick someone like Claire O'Neill, or the party might pick someone like Claire O'Neill to be deputy leader, and then suddenly you have a woman in that position who is then very close to the top job. As I said before, it feels like a lot of it does come down to the factions, and I think that there is some frustration around some in the party who think that there should be more women in those kind of power broker positions. I mean, one person said to me that until those change, there is no change, that sort of final hurdle of getting from senior cabinet minister to a prime minister or to a leader, that gap there is very much sort of determined by those power broker figures. And so when those change, then change becomes a lot easier as well in those numbers. But there are so many variables to this, Rafka, in terms of how long Labor lasts in power, who does become the next leader, whether the dynamic between, you know, the numbers that the left has and the numbers that the right have, and the fact that the right are very divided at the moment, whether they become more united. There are so many kind of factors to this. It's so hard to know what happens next.
Thank you so much, Krishani, for your time and for your insights.
Thanks, Rafka.
That was political reporter Krishani Danchi. You can find more of her work on theguardian.com. And we've linked her latest piece on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria. Sound design and mixing by Lou Hill. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also leave a review. I'm Raf Katuma. Thanks for listening.